The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Okay, so hi. Thank you all for coming, I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate this conference, actually. I've been coming here for years. So, I gotta stick to the script on this one, unfortunately, based on some unusual circumstances. My name is Mark Rennell. I'll be presenting this talk as an independent scholar. The presentation is titled Safety Critical Software Certification and Why Free Software Might Be the Best Solution. Disclaimer, super important. The opinions expressed in this presentation are the views of the author and do not reflect the official policy or position of any agency of the United States government. My background, so you know where I'm coming from. I have a PhD in computer science and engineering from Penn State University. My bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering both come from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm licensed and board certified professional engineer in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I'm also a union representative in the federal service. All of these things are important for what you're about to hear. So next slide, if I do this right, is just the GNU free documentation license. So I'm releasing it that way. So for this slide is supposed to be about motivation. So let me just say, I'm gonna go off script, which I will try not to do in the future, but people who know me often ask me why I'm doing this. This is career suicide. Like, why would you go up and describe what you're about to describe? And let me just say that I'm doing this out of a sense of civics, right? The idea of good governance, that's very important to me. Free and fair elections, super important to me, okay? And then, I also want you to know that no matter what you hear today, how bad it sounds, my family still flies. My wife goes to conferences in Europe, like in Berlin. I just met Matthias from Berlin, and she goes to the Middle East for conferences, for academic conferences. My daughter flies, just came back from France, and my son also flies to the West Coast regularly. So we are using the aerospace, the national aerospace system. Okay? Now, so failures in aviation software certification are a matter of public concern. That is a key word, public concern, okay? This is serious stuff. Agency retaliation against federal employees slash regulators who raise concerns, including aircraft software safety, race and religious discrimination, nepotism, and things like quid pro quo, chill employees from speaking out against public threats. The No Fear Act and the Whistleblower Protection Program do not provide a shield to those employees, period. In the US, when we go to a restaurant or purchase food at a grocery, we don't expect to get poisoned. We don't expect our kids to die when we bring the food home. If we give our kids a chocolate bar, we don't expect it will cause brain damage. Anybody get Consumer Reports in the United States? It's a magazine. And they just did a report on chocolate and the amount of, I think it's lead and cadmium in things like standard chocolate bars here, and how the lead and cadmium levels in those chocolate bars all exceed levels that are safe. This is serious, right? So, the question is safety in transportation, and especially aviation safety, a priority, right? So when we travel, like on a cruise ship, on a train, in an airplane, we expect to get through that trip safely, or we would not go. As an example of past federal oversight here in the United States, let's look at the tobacco industry. So the tobacco industry regulators, right, they let the tobacco companies for years tell us tobacco was safe. Tobacco is still on the market, and kids are still using it in different forms. It's just not as much cigarettes. Now it's the inhalers. The products poisoned us. Were any federal tobacco regulators ever held accountable? What did the fire retardants that were put in furniture, bedding, and pajamas do to us and our kids? Cigarettes caused so many fires in households. I mean, if your neighbor's apartment went up, what's saving your apartment, right? Even if you don't smoke, you're still at risk. So in order to protect us all, they forced fire retardant chemicals into our bedding, into our kids' pajamas, and into our furniture to prevent those fires from going more out of control than they did anyway. So what about rail hazardous materials? Here in the United States, I don't know if everyone's heard this or is coming from abroad, but we had a fairly significant accident in a place called East Palestine, Ohio, just recently. Were there any consequences to federal rail regulators? What I'm talking about, note, it's a big difference. I'm not saying that Norfolk Southern, the company, should be held accountable. I'm not saying that, you know, Boeing Aircraft or Sikorsky should be held accountable, although they should be held accountable. But what I'm suggesting is U.S. federal regulators have a job to protect us. We pay our taxes, and we expect to be protected. So there's also recently a flight out of Keene, New Hampshire on March 3rd, 2023. A business jet departed a small New England airport, and it was buffeted by severe turbulence, killing a passenger, right? So this is just a couple of weeks ago. And it had to be diverted. So why do federal regulators allow aircraft passengers to hold infants in their laps? That is still legitimate in the United States. Why is this not like allowing a roller coaster ride participant to hold an unsecured infant in their lap during the ride? I mean, you wouldn't do that, I hope, right? Most of you? So I don't go on roller coasters, so So there's conflicts of interest in the federal aviation oversight system. So U.S. federal regulatory environment is conflicted. It's not dependable. I don't know if you heard, too, just recently, I think, like, Huffington Post, either yesterday or the day before, posted a story that Boeing lawyers have decided that the people who died on the two MAX Boeing 737 accidents did not feel any pain. And if you know anything about the accident, they didn't die instantly. It was a prolonged situation. Anyway, there's no consequences for management if failures cause fatalities. There's no federal accountability, right? For whatever reason, in the United States, we have this thing called sovereign immunity, right? It does not belong in a representative democracy. Here we elect our representatives to represent us. Who's the sovereign? I know that recently the previous president had declared himself the king of a certain ethnic minority, and there's still stuff going on related to that, but we do not have a sovereign. And we should not allow federal regulators or any federal agent, any federal employee, to get away with something that's illegal, that's criminal, because of sovereign immunity. They are not supposed to be above the law. That's the great thing about the United States. That's why I like civics. The president is not a king. His power does not derive from God. He is liable to the law. Nobody in the United States is supposed to be above the law. For those of you who are coming from abroad, Sorry, this is kind of US-centric, and I know some of you have kings, so it's fine. I mean, you know, whatever people want, but in the United States, we don't have a king, and we're not supposed to. So there's a revolving door between government managers, between the company and government promotions and jobs. They like to have people who are considered to have a lot of experience, especially in the airline industry, to become managers for the oversight. It has a lot of side effects that are not necessarily good, and I'm not even sure it's really necessary. U.S. regulators and managers, unfortunately, are not exposed to accident victims' families. They don't see the consequences of their failures. I mean, if you meet some of these families that have lost loved ones, I mean, there's this guy, I'm going off topic again, poor Paul Norridge, I'm suddenly blanking on his last name, Norridge, I think. He's from Canada. All three of his kids, his wife and his mother-in-law, all died on one of those MAX flights. His whole family is gone. I'm sorry this isn't as funny as some of the other talks, and I'm trying not to, because it's serious stuff. All right, biggest threat to software oversight. Public safety is threatened by federal oversight corruption. When FAA employee complains about discrimination, safety concerns, etc., management often initiates what's called a security and hazardous material safety, or ASH, investigation of that employee. ASH employees carry guns and badges. I don't know if you've noticed, but a lot of minority people who were just trying to go home have been murdered on their way home by police officers, okay? The police officers have been trained pretty well not to go around shooting the public unnecessarily. As a matter of fact, their primary job, a police officer's primary job, should really be to protect and to serve. Service should be like 95% of their job. These internal investigators, I don't think they get the same level of training, and the threat with the stupid gun happens. Back to the script. All right, so ASH employees carry these badges and guns. Regulator complaints are often ignored. Only the employee is investigated. So if management gets annoyed because somebody gives a pitch and says, hey, we need outside checks on our oversight process, there's problems, especially with software, then managers are like, we want to keep this quiet. We don't want this out in the public, right? So the regulator's complaint gets ignored. Only the employee is investigated. Software review or regulatory work that that employee was doing, who is now under investigation, they don't care about that. That gets thrown out the window. If that was the source of the complaint, yeah. The issue is to stop that regulator from talking in public. Even if the employee investigation goes nowhere, no consequences for the manager, harassment, discrimination, retaliation against regulators stops the oversight, right? You depend on that oversight. That's what I was trying to point out with the rail and with the other issues. Applicant proprietary software is then left without oversight, and it's proprietary, right? You can't get into it. You can't look at it. That's why I'm here. Safety critical software must be free software. That's my point today. Free software may allow public review of applicant flight critical software regardless of outcomes for individual regulators. Slide 7. Okay. So free software definition of what free software is. The four essential freedoms are up here on the slide. Safety critical code, you need to have public review, right? Free software, if safety critical software were free by requirement, by regulation, then that would give accident victim families representatives access to the code and requirements, bypassing systemic FAA barriers. And that way you might also see, it might highlight missing or lax oversight. Like if suddenly you see serious problems in the code, hey, why aren't the regulators checking that out? Why aren't there questions about that? Requirements are source code, okay? Free software defines source code as the place where changes are implemented. No argument as to whether requirements are source code. I had somebody very high up at the FAA. I'm very low. Even though I have a PhD, they don't want me talking to you guys, so they keep me like at the lowest level, and I am like kept down on pretty low. But somebody who was very high up came into the break room while I was in there and started explaining to me, first of all, that the MCAS stuff, the software worked perfectly. It followed what the requirements told it to do. And it was not the job of the FAA to review those software requirements as software. Okay? With free software, it's really specific. It says very clearly that software requirements are part of the source code. It's where you make the changes, right, to change that code. So there must be strong consequences for copyleft violations. Free software and copyleft must be strictly enforced for public safety. So presentation scope, we can't look at everything today. So we're mostly looking at civil aviation software regulation because that's what I'm most familiar with. And that's what I've seen from the inside where it's not as pretty as one would hope. So I'm gonna limit the scope of this to that. So my background is I worked at the Federal Aviation Administration doing software reviews for 15 years. To certify aviation software, all federal aviation regulators have a set of what are called orders. Remember, we have like veterans preference. So we have a strong US military presence in our system because we're supposed to hire a lot of veterans. So we have a set of orders which we're supposed to follow, and the one for software is Order 8110-49A, Software Approval Guidelines. All that order basically tells us to do is turn around and use the Radio Technical Commission for Aeronautics, RTCA, DO-178 guidance to certify software. Most of the world's civilian aviation authorities use this DO-178 to certify safety-critical software. Docs for showing compliance. So DO-178, what does that do? That, in turn, shows compliance for Regulation 1309. In the federal aviation regulations here in the United States, there are four sections, basically, that we work to. I mean, there's more, but the four main ones are transport category, which is if you flew to the conference, you're generally flying on a transport category aircraft. The second one is for general aviation. These are like Pipers, Cessnas, small aircraft that are, you know, limited to like less than, I can't remember, 6 or 10 passengers. And then there are two categories of helicopters. There's large helicopters, sort of like Sikorsky and Bell has some, and then there's smaller helicopters, which are the ones you mostly see doing like traffic reports. Those are Robinsons. So news agencies like to use the smaller ones, and they're one of the biggest sellers, actually. So another thing I'm not going to cover today, which is really critical, is the item at the bottom. Major versus minor software changes, right? So they don't yet define, and they haven't in my 15 years, what a minor software change is, right? But we do have minor software changes, because if you just change like a limit, you know, or some kind of a fixed constant that's not really critical, you don't necessarily have to go through and recertify the entire system. You're doing a relatively small change, right? But after a while, after you do so many small changes, how many of those small changes does it take to add up to equal one major change when you're starting to run more risk with the changes you're doing? Whoops. Am I in the right place? Yes. Okay, so DO-178 software certification in aviation. So as federal regulators, we use this DO-178 guidance. What does it basically do? Okay? Most of you who do code development here are actually pretty familiar with what I'm about to talk about, which is there are four basic things that we make sure that applicant software does when we go to certify it. One is use a configuration management system like SVN or Git. Another one is that they use some form of a bug tracker to track bugs, right? Another one is that they do verification and testing of both the requirements and the code, and then we also make sure that they meet software quality assurance goals, like they have, they follow code standards, or they, when they make changes, they have some kind of change control board to ensure that the process has some oversight internally. So there are two types of reviews that we do as regulators. One is an on-site audit, which is the one you guys want us to do, right? That's where we go out to the applicant, the big company, and we can physically talk to the individuals who have done the work. So I can talk to the coders. If it, you know, when I was doing it, I could talk to the coders, I could talk to the people doing configuration management and quality assurance, and I could talk to the people doing testing, and I could make sure that the, I could verify the independence of testers from coders, okay? And one of the big things we do as part of our check is just to pick, say, five. We do see the requirements that would need to be, I agree, absolutely. And that is, yeah, you're right. I that's something I should add. Because right now we do certify the programming environment as part of oversight. So it's a very good point. No, it's good. Hey, guys, should I move on?
We just got things working.
Awesome. Beautiful timing. Thanks a lot for the support, too. I mean, you guys have been doing, actually, I know things bust, but I really appreciate what you're doing. Especially as having done IT myself. All right, did I already cover this? Slide 10? Did I? All right, so I just got to be careful of time, and I lost my own clock here. So the on-site audits allow us to go to the applicant directly, ask the coders, ask the testers, right? Unfortunately, what our guys tend to prefer is that they want us to do something called a post-implementation audit, right? So a post-implementation audit is where they basically throw the code out into the field. It's already flying. No oversight. Now, after the fact, the applicant sends boxes of material for, you know, code. They send the coding standards. They send material so that at our desks, after it's already fielded, we can then take a look at it and do an audit. And after it's out, then if we find something wrong, we can potentially say something. But it's pretty hard at that point. So those are the two types of audits we do. So there are obvious problems, right? So I think we've covered a lot of these now in the questions. Just be aware, most regulators cannot code. They are not academically trained in software. That is for safety critical. If it's like flight entertainment system, all right, no problem. But if it's like flying the airplane in automation, you want whoever's doing that review to know algorithms, to know operating systems, to know programming languages. Like the programming language that's picked is critical. Like you don't probably think about that, but most of what they do for safety critical code is something called schematic capture, right? It's what we call visual programming in academics, and it is a mess to try and find bugs, to try and debug. It's you know, you can have lines from a schematic going off to all different drawings, and you can have multiple drawings, like pages and pages of them. Did I went over applicant data retention, right? So let's go to the next one. Try and keep moving here. So Code of Federal Regulations, 1309. Software compliance is found against this regulation. There's the four types I mentioned, right? Am I in the right place? Yeah. So the item that is, all 1309 says, it is not software specific. All of our software that we're regulating, we don't have really. I mean, there's like two software regulations for engines. But that's about it in the entire Code of Federal Regulations for aviation. I mean, it is pretty wild. Okay, so what 1309 says is it just says the item that you're checking has to perform its intended function. If it's a toaster, it has to make toast and not burn it. That's not obviously safety critical, but that's the idea. So the 1309 tries to basically enforce these design assurance levels, which actually come from a different documentary. I'll talk about them. But there are five design assurance levels. The top three, catastrophic, it's where you totally lose the aircraft. If there is a bug or a fault in catastrophic level software, it's a problem. Then there's hazardous, and hazardous significantly increases pilot workload. So the individuals who are in charge of flying your aircraft, if they have a hazardous bug go off, suddenly they are heavily distracted and they are doing their best to keep you safe. Next one down is major. That's a problem, but it's not quite as bad as the top two. And then there's minor and no safety effect. For software audits, we have such limited access and we're so kind of understaffed. We generally only concentrate on levels A, B, and C. And we probably need to concentrate on the safety-related requirements from something called the Preliminary System Safety Assessment, or PSSA. So what's the PSSA? So there are these two guidance documents, which we're going to talk about the Functional Hazard Assessment and the Preliminary System Safety Assessment. So there are these two documents, SAE ARP 4754A and 4761. And what they basically tell the applicants to do is look over their designs, find all the failures, map them out, and put those in the functional hazard assessment. Then all of those failures need to have some kind of mitigation against them. For software, those mitigations should be found in the PSSA. In 15 years of aviation software certification, I have never seen a PSSA while doing audits. I've never participated in functional hazard assessment creation as software oversight. I think if we could get more access to these two items, that would really help with safety, even if, just for starters, right? And I'm telling you guys, because I've tried to tell our management, I've tried to just quietly discuss it with them, and they are not really happy to talk about stuff, mostly because most of them don't know software, they can't code. They don't know, whatever. So, as part of our oversight, regulators should trace relevant failures from the functional hazard assessment down into the PSSA, make sure they have corresponding safety requirements, and then those safety requirements should trace down into the software requirements for those elements that are relevant to software, and so forth. Let's move. How am I doing on time? 4 minutes, that's pretty tight. So this one's on the preliminary system safety assessment. So this is where the design assurance levels occur, and also the functional hazard analysis happens here. Something else that I haven't mentioned yet is common cause analysis. So that checks for independence between function systems to satisfy safety or regulatory requirements so that the same failure does not take out both the primary system and the backup system. If the primary goes down, the pilot is going to expect to be able to fail over to the backup system, and that's going to work. When you have a common cause error, the same bug will take out both, and the pilot will be left with nothing. Let's skip that. So potential free software benefits, right? Applicants in the agency claim a lack of resources to devote to certification. That is somewhat true. I mean, there just aren't a lot of us who have software backgrounds and academics working these issues. So free software offers real time-saving solutions. Code component reuse, core software skeletons can be used, like certifying an operating system, and then you just develop specific device drivers for each aircraft or specific modules to allow the integration, right? The same way, basically, the GNU Linux kernel works. Also, then, you have joint maintenance of core software, and you have joint development of the documentation. So, like, to me, to a large degree, free software seems like a no-brainer, although hopefully I'll get feedback from you guys, because maybe you see other issues. I think this is the last slide. Thanks a lot for your patience, guys. So keep safety critical code simple. Like, this probably seems obvious to everybody in this audience, but the agency just hired a specialist who does both artificial intelligence and machine learning because they want to stay on top of the curve. If it's safety critical, you don't want necessarily a virtual machine, which is an operating system running on top of an operating system. You may not even want an operating system, honestly. You don't want artificial intelligence. Can you imagine having a fight with a chatbot while you're trying to keep an airplane under control? Like, who needs that, you know? And then, like, machine learning? maybe not right now, you know? And also, be aware that the U.S. National Aerospace is getting ready to implement drones. And when I say drones, I don't mean like the little ones that go up and take the beautiful pictures, and if it hits something, who cares? I'm talking about like a full transport category aircraft with boxes so that a delivery company can fly that aircraft from point to point without a pilot, right? Sounds like, who cares? But if that thing comes down in the wrong place, you could have a real problem. And we have had accidents where aircraft have come down in like Queens. We've had aircraft come down in Manhattan, like helicopters. There was Pan Am. So, oh, I'm sorry, one more slide, conclusion here. Software certification also needs empirical, peer-reviewed, repeatable, external evaluation and verification. Government aviation software oversight needs outside review with consequences. When was the last time you heard of a federal regulator getting in trouble for not doing their job, for being negligent? In the United States, I've never heard of that. Sovereign immunity does not belong here. Okay, so just be aware of, you know, we have aircraft now coming in, a lot of them with electric motors. We have vertical takeoff and landing vehicles that are going to do that from urban areas as opposed to airports. You know, Warren Zevon has that song about poor, poor, pitiful me, and he talks about a wearing blender being chewed up like a, anyway. And we don't want that. We want these vertical takeoff and landing aircraft to work because it'll, first of all, it's good for our environment to get electric aircraft going. It's going to help us get in and out with traffic, and it's going to help with emergencies like ambulance evacuations. I want electric vehicles or vertical takeoff and landing vehicles to succeed. We need oversight at the agency for software. We need oversight and management from individuals academically trained in the field of software, in the subject of software, thoroughly trained. And we need a lot of them, not just one or two that can be, they can just say, oh, well, it's a problem with that individual. Government aviation software oversight needs outside review with As we move forward in some of these like urban mobility systems, we have higher dependence as the public on reliable safety critical software. Existing federal software certification and program management have demonstrated that they are unreliable. Free software offers a much more open and reviewable approach to safety critical software. So it may not be perfect, but at least now you guys can start to see what the hell is going on. So it's not just some poor person like me who's stuck in there getting PTSD, but you guys can see, because you can read the code, what I'm seeing. And so I would really appreciate that. I know you probably don't want to see it, but anyway, I think I'm done. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you for your patience. How much? Yeah, how much time do we have? Yeah, come up and use the mic if you can.
Would you also say that if the code would be free software, that it would help people like you more to have a discussion with the rest of society about specific parts in the software?
Yes. Excellent point. Thanks a lot, Matthias. Yeah, very good point. Absolutely. Any other questions? Because there's been a lot going on in the national airspace recently. You guys ask it, I will do my damnedest to answer.
When you're doing reviews within the FAA versus what would or could be happening if this were to be open source, what are the, I guess the reviewer, is this a third party unbiased reviewer from a different company? Would that be something that changes if this software were required to be open sourced? What goes on with those equities?
That's a great question. I mean, you could definitely, like if there's an accident, right? Both sides, the company and the victim's families, could both hire their own experts, and then you could have disagreements between the experts. I think that's what you're driving at, right? So that's all true, but imagine if it's free software, well, then the public has access too. So it's not just the biased expert and whoever, it's now you guys. And you guys can also be hired, which I think would be really, really cool because I kind of been coming to this conference and I trust you guys more than a lot of other I mean, I love free software compared to what I have to look at, you know? Anyway, thank you for the question. You guys have no questions? Nobody here flew to the conference?
I'm actually just waiting for people to ask the relative ones.
Do you guys have a mic?
Just kind of as a personal note, I was very glad to see your mention about disability access up on one of your first slides there. Because I will say I personally avoid flying if at all possible because of my one experience. Had nothing to do with the flight. It was the pain of getting on and off the damn plane.
Right. And why is that? I mean, we have laws that require access.
ADA does not comply to aviation.
No. But maybe it should, right?
The Air Carrier Access Act, which is much weaker, and I can't go to the bathroom unless I'm on a three-aisle plane.
Right. Hopefully I mentioned the bathrooms because those always bother me. I mean, even if you're absolutely fully abled and relatively small, those bathrooms are tight.
Yeah.
The Airbus has really nice bathrooms. I don't know if you guys have been on some of those.
Like I say, anything other than smaller than a two-aisle aircraft, they don't have the transport chair on the plane that is needed to get me from my seat to the bathroom.
Why do you need a transport? Why can't you just wheel in on your, equipment?
That would be nice. I have seen some discussion. Basically, the question of how you secure the random wheelchair to meet something similar to the standards that it would have for an aircraft seat.
That's a good point.
They don't tie me down on the subway. On the buses, they do strap my chair down.
You know what they use at the FAA? Duct tape. I mean, they use that to repair aircraft and fly them back. Like, they'll duct tape up wings. It's insane.
They're really strong on Amtrak.
Amtrak, just a regular public bus, has access, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, and who sits at the front of the bus? It's people with disabilities, families with small children. What's going on the aircraft that you have the most wealthiest segment of society who gets to take those seats?
Yes, I'm also the first person on, but the last person off.
Right, which is
and
also,
one of the things that is kind of amusing sometimes is you see the miracle cures of the person who's early boarding because of a disability, but hops up and runs off the plane when it lands.
Right, I'm sure that can be solved too, actually. But thank you. Thanks a lot. Do you have a?
I have a quick question from IRC. Do the aircraft manufacturers develop the source code, or do they outsource it to other companies?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, they can either develop it in-house, which some companies do, or they can outsource it to contractors. And then if they outsource it to contractors, it's the main company that would be reliant to us, and they have to answer us. And then their subcontractors are responsible to them because of legal liability issues. Are we cutting into the next person's talk? Let me know.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. My work is in human-robot interactions. I do some stuff with like formal guarantees and stuff, so a lot of what you were doing I thought was really interesting. And we're trying to learn lessons from, in particular, the FAA, because we're seeing robots potentially, be in these more hazardous scenarios, like self-driving cars is a really big example.
Yeah.
And there's talk of creating a sort of FAA for self-driving cars, because right now we don't have that accountability. Like, the closest we have is the NHTSB, which is ineffective for that kind of thing.
Okay, listen to what I'm telling you very carefully. There are not a lot of software people who are trained academically at the agency, regardless of how great they tell you they are.
No, I know. And so I was just kind of wondering, what lessons can we learn in terms of if there's a potential opportunity, right, to create the ideal agency. And so what does that look like, I guess?
That's a good question. I'm personally against making major changes to government agencies. I think you should tweak them. It could be way worse. They just did a major change to the civilian system for certification of all, new aircraft and changes. And in doing that major change, they intentionally, as far as I can tell, made things a lot looser, right? So you want to be careful in terms of any major change and just make minor tweaks. But you have a really tough task ahead of you. Like, I would not, that's a tough job. I mean, I have trouble sleeping.
No, did you see the NIST recommendations that just came out?
No. That's great. Yeah, sorry. Thanks a lot for your patience, and thanks a lot for coming. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so I apologize if you already mentioned this, but I was curious about if you can speak to the Boeing 787 software autopilot error. I'm not sure the exact model name, but a few years back they had to recall a bunch of planes, right? Because some planes went down, I think, in north of Africa, and then they recalled a bunch of planes. There was a software, and it was a software bug where the autopilot was it, maybe, do you know what I'm talking about here at all? Or?
So I think you're talking about the Boeing 737 MAX NCAS.
Yes, the MAX, yes.
Where in that aircraft, they kept trying to keep the Boeing 737 because pilots already know how to fly that aircraft.
Right.
So they were saying, hey, you can put your pilots into this new version of this aircraft without any, you know, without significant training. What they did is they put really big engines on this aircraft, so much bigger than what they used to be. So they had to move the engines forward to fit them under the wing. And in doing so, they increase the potential for stall, right? So in order to counteract that potential for stall, they created something called an MCAS software. Mm-hmm. And the MCAS software was basically to keep the plane's nose down. So in stall, you pitch up too much and then you lose lift. So basically, if you take my first name, last name, put it into YouTube and look at the video, it's like a 15-minute video. That one's on Kobe Bryant. But down in the comment section for that video, there's pointer to papers published with the ACM. It's freely available, you can pull the PDF.
Okay.
That talks about some issues related to a variety of aircraft accidents. I think there's a paragraph in there on the Boeing stuff. And I'm not involved with Boeing. I don't have access to Boeing certification, although I was just accused of having released some of it, but I actually have never worked on Boeing. So all I can do is tell you some things that I've heard peripherally from other regulators.
Got it.
But they, like companies like that often don't even want me near their stuff.
Right, but at the FAA, you are regulating, you know, these companies like Boeing, right? So you are involved with them to some extent sometimes, or?
So I was initially put in a local area certification office that actually did helicopter.
Mm.
So we have a big East Coast helicopter company that makes big helicopters. And I was put in to go look at their software. And I started asking questions, which is my job as a regulator. And the next thing I know, my manager says, hey, you're off the team. So what they do is they just pull me off. So if they don't want to answer the questions, it's called, it's basically shopping for the regulator they want.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. The thing with MCAS, too, is the tragic flaw there was that the whole system on pitching the nose down was based on one sensor as opposed to a pair of sensors or more than a pair. So if the one sensor failed, which it did in both cases, then you had that tragic fault. Are we done here?
Yeah, we're out of time, but thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks for coming.